Hey, welcome back to Past Gas. This week, part one of our series on Dodge. We're talking about John and Horace Dodge, the brothers that started the Dodge brand. Did you know they actually did a lot of work with Henry Ford? Yeah, they built a ton of stuff for Ford, a lot of engines, transmissions for those Model Ts. Eventually, they were able to start their own company and take it to Henry Ford, the eccentric, weird guy who ate a lot of weeds around his house because he believed it was healthier than vegetables. That's a real thing that happened. Let's get into Dodge part one. John Dodge, the nerdier and more marketing-focused Dodge brother, was searching for any way he could to position their brand new Dodge 3035 as a better Model T. Henry Ford was blasting the public with a full-on campaign around his very successful car that was, in John's opinion and reality, an unsafe piece of junk. John wanted to prove his car was much safer than the Model A, which had a precariously mounted gas tank directly under the front seat and was prone to fires. So, he and his brother Horace jumped in their car and took off. John floored his namesake Dodge 3035 and chugged it to a blistering 20 miles per hour.
Whoa, too fast!
Whoa!
At the end of the path lay a brick wall. One side of their Detroit factory, John braced himself. The Dodge smashed into the brick wall at almost full speed.
Ow.
But despite this, John was just fine. He'd survived, and his car hadn't burst into flames or fallen apart at all. The experiment was so successful that the U.S. government immediately ordered 250 of Dodge's 3035s for deployment to the Mexican border.
That's what you call making a point.
Soon after, Dodge launched an ad campaign that coined the term dependability in the auto market. And more than 100 years later, Dodge is still a household name. Dependability notwithstanding. I can say that. I drive a Ram. How did two brothers who built bicycles pull off the quickest rise to success in the automotive industry? How did they exploit a friendship with Henry Ford to build one of the largest car companies on the planet? And how did a lethal case of the flu create the Big Three? Well, this week we're going to find out. This is part one of Dodge.
You guys think he could run 20 miles per hour?
Yeah.
No.
Absolutely. 20. No.
Want to run 20?
I know that. Watching football, Tyreek Hill is one of the fastest people in the world, and he runs 23 miles per hour with a football.
Okay. How fast is Noah Lyles? Got the Olympics.
I think those guys run like 26, 27 okay. miles per hour.
I know our e-bikes go about 25, and there's no way I'm keeping up with that.
So. Okay, how about this? Let's go up after this. Let's go run 20 miles per hour
with
outside.
With a speed gun?
With a speed gun, or with a car, just keeping 20 miles per hour. Let's try to keep up with it.
Okay,
we have the scooter. The scooter will do it.
We'll do 20?
Someone can.
Okay, we're going
to
try.
All right, actually, we'll put that footage in the end of this episode so you have to watch the whole thing to watch that.
Yes. Oh, man, I got to start. I wore boots today.
Same.
Oh, boy.
Totally wrong shoe for this, but let's try. Okay.
Those are something that, like, need to be cobbled together, huh?
Yeah, they're kind of old now.
You need to go get those repaired.
I do. Welcome back to Past Gas, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes. There's an audience right behind this camera. It's kind of freaking me out a little bit, to be honest, but hello. Welcome, you guys. Welcome, audience.
The winner of our Zoomies PT Cruiser contest. Is in the studio with us today. His name is Luke. He won our PT Cruiser, which is awesome.
With nitrous.
Well, the bottle's not included.
Oh, yeah. No.
You gotta get
what
your
will
own nitrous.
You do?
My name is Nolan Sykes. I already said that. Across from me today is Justin Freeman.
What up?
Noted truck guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Are you a big Dodge guy?
If it's got a Cummins in it, sure.
All right.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'd laugh like that. My next to me, as always, wearing a new wool hat.
Whoa.
Tired from fresh from taking care of his baby this weekend. It's yeah. Joe, it's Joe Weber.
What's up, Wink Wink Nation? I could sell credit to credit card. Oil to your soil.
Are you a big Dodge guy? What's your opinion on Dodge, Joe? What's your hot take on the Dodge brand?
I say this a lot, but as someone who lives next to a freeway on ramp, I cannot stand Hellcats anymore. Yeah. I'm done with them. Yep. I went to the LA Auto Show last week and I saw the new Challenger.
Mm-hmm.
Challenger, right?
Charger.
Sorry.
Because you plug it in.
It sounds weird and it's too loud for just a little speaker making engine noises. And
so you got to hear it.
They're playing it.
Yeah. Yeah. They had a whole press conference. We went to the press day. The Fratzonic.
Fratzonic.
It's just a speaker inside of a muffler.
Yeah.
It's just a fancy name for that.
That's an interesting idea. Mm. But yeah, I don't know how I'll.
Yeah. So
make our audience more annoying?
Oh, wait, EVs aren't annoying enough. We gotta put a
crap,
speaker.
It would be cool if you could customize the noises, like just Kendrick yelling mustard.
Dude.
Yeah.
Oh, it's super fun. Did you listen to Kendrick's new album?
I sure did.
GNX,
yeah.
Which I think is so sick that
pretty good.
He's mentioned the Buick GNX in King's Dead before.
Mm.
I bought an 85 for the weekend.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He's a Buick guy. I've always loved the GNX. We're not talking about Buick today.
We're talking about a brand that I love very much, or I have a complicated relationship with, let's say. I mean, Dodge and Chrysler, like muscle cars were definitely my big first step into car culture. Like I loved everything that, like your Plymouths, your Dodges, like Dodge Charger, Challenger, especially getting to drive Jay Leno's Challenger was like a dream come true. That thing is just one of the coolest cars ever. Dodge Viper, also another huge bucket list thing. Doing the every Viper video
was a great day.
Amazing, one of the best days of this job ever.
Oh yeah, both of you were in that video, huh?
I made a feature, but I was there that day, so I got to do some of the B-roll driving. It was awesome.
It was just the best. So Dodge definitely occupies. I drive a Dodge single cab pickup truck.
I do like your
had
truck.
Some issues with it this weekend driving out to Tucson. It's so funny, dude. My transmission started overheating, and my sister and my dad have both had Ram trucks, and my sister had to get her and her husband had to replace the transmission on their Ram that did not have that many miles. So, like, when I bought mine, I was like, yeah, that was probably just, like, you know,
it's a fluke.
And
then as it's happening, I'm on the road, I'm like, there were signs. There were warning signs. I was just so mad. But we think we found the issue, and we'll fix it. But anyway, Dodge these days, I think, has like there's a bit of a stigma to their reputation. People who drive them, the aforementioned Hellcats on the 110 freeway on ramps.
It's also like a takeover car.
Yeah. I mean, it's very affordable horsepower.
They also advertise like a self-proclaimed last stand. You know,
I'm just punching on my way out.
I mean, James used to say like Dodge is the company that's throwing a party at the end of the world. They didn't care for the longest time. We're just coming out with huge V8s when everyone else was going hybrid or whatever.
We will not conform.
Yeah.
And then they immediately go, all right, so we kind of had to.
Yeah. Oh, and then, we talk about the promotional video that Dodge came out with a couple months ago with the CEO at the time. I think he has since stepped down.
Really?
Yeah, he left because he made it seem like government's trying to make me stop making V8s and I don't want to because of the brotherhood.
He kept the note, I guess.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah. So Tim Kaniskis, this is from Car and Driver. He's retiring.
Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting news. So the party at the end of the world, not doing the hybrid stuff, but probably very consciously in the back of the mind being like, we need to make some more efficient
engines. And I think the Hurricane Straight Six and was like their
the
answer to that.
Of that. Exactly.
It could be cool.
Could be. We'll see.
We'll see what the recall is.
Well, before we jump into it, we have a road and snack segment today.
Oh.
Justin, you want to do the honors?
Sure.
It's covered by the Zoomies catalog because it's too big to fit in there.
We got some chips. From a different country.
Finger licking braised pork flavor Lay's. Oh my.
Were these sent to us?
Audrey bought them.
Oh, Audrey bought them. All right.
Where did you buy these?
Where'd you buy these, Audrey?
A bakery
in Culver City.
All right, cool. Let's pop this open.
So it's a Chinese snack.
I'll be respectful to the container.
Oh, yeah. Nice ASMR.
Is there a plastic
There's
piece?
There's a sleeve.
Ooh. Keeps it
like Oreos. Mm. Here we go, boys. Take a cup.
No more getting your hands stuck in the Pringles container.
Oh, man.
Hands are too big for the Pringles.
They have kind of like a corn chip consistency.
The texture is definitely almost sandpapery.
Sweeter than I thought it was going to be.
Pass those over to the the audience back there.
Zoomies, guys, you got to hit
try
this.
That out.
Mm. They taste like ramen to me.
I was about to say, this tastes like what ramen seasoning should be.
Mm.
I f*** with these, though. These are
That's
good.
That's delicious.
Yeah.
These are super good.
But the sweetness is a little off.
It's a little weird.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's both savory and sweet.
What are you guys saying? Mm. Seems some nods over there.
Out of 10, what you got?
Yeah. Okay, not too bad.
Yeah. Bring it back. Where'd it go?
I think they're pretty good.
That's delicious. And it's not overpowering.
No.
You know?
Subtle.
You know what?
Because easily something like that with that kind of flavor will stick on your tongue.
Yeah.
And I don't feel the need to drink after this. That's good.
That's a good delicious. Sign. Not my favorite thing we've had on here, but like it's not very offensive. It doesn't stick on the tongue. It's not super filling, which is good. I think you don't want to be like stuffed, right?
Because you want to still hit In-N-Out if you're on a road trip.
Exactly.
And you want to blast your appetite.
Exactly.
With some finger licking
chips.
So
for that, you know what? I'll bring it up a 7.5 out of 10 for me because
that's
of
good.
That.
Four grams of protein.
What?
Yeah. I'm eating my
the
Lay's
whole
for protein.
Container is one serving, just under 500 calories.
I think.
Oh wow.
500 calories.
Okay. Ooh. And there's a lot of salt too.
I think the tray makes it a better road food.
That's what I was going to say. I would have given this a 7 if it weren't for the tray, but because of the tray, it makes it easier to eat in the car.
Yeah, you just plop that into your, depending on how your cup holder is shaped, like my Dodge Ram, you could just put it in there because they're not like, it's all one.
Yeah. Thing. So I'm going to give it a 7.8 out of 10. Justin, what do you
those
think?
Those are good.
Mm. Yeah, those are good.
These are really good.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a 7.8
out of 10.
7.3 for me.
7,
delicious.
3?
Mm. 8 out of 10. Final answer.
Okay.
Those are excellent.
Average of about 7.6. That's pretty good.
It's a good flavor. Lay's, bring that to the U.S.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
Today, the legacy of the Dodge brothers has inundated every aspect of the automotive industry. From the beefy 1970 426 Challenger Hemi that was a huge part of the original muscle car wars to the all-new retro-inspired Challenger reigniting the muscle car race in the late 2000s, Dodge has always been at the leading edge of performance and innovation. I guess we'll see.
They lead the edge. They don't stay ahead.
Yeah.
Hey, fair enough. But it wasn't always that way. It all started way back in 1864 when the older Dodge brother, John Francis, was born just outside South Bend, Indiana, in Niles, Michigan. John Francis Dodge would grow up to be the numbers guy. He had sales and paper spreadsheets on the brain. 4 years later, the younger, mechanically minded Dodge brother, Horace Elgin, was born. From day one, Horace was the one taking apart everything in sight and cobbling it back together, while John stayed inside with his calculators.
Touch grass, John.
Meanwhile, in high school, Horace built a penny farthing from scrap.
You know these bikes? The crazy bikes with the huge wheel?
Big wheel in the front.
Yeah.
Small one in the back.
It's a skill to get on top of it and to get off of it.
A lot of guys in Portland ride them, I assume.
No, they ride the bikes that you weld two or three bikes together. Mm. It's like a tall bike.
Tall bike.
Which are a whole nother level of dangerous.
From the time they were both in short pants.
What?
The Dodge brothers were never not together. Their father, Daniel Rugg Dodge, owned and ran the Dodge Railroad Standpipe and Machine Company with his two brothers.
Do you think he went by Daniel or Rugg?
Rugg. Hey, Rugg.
Faze Rugg.
Rugg.
I think
that's Dan Rugg.
That's not a bad name.
Rugg would be, it's a good nickname.
Rugg would be cool. Yeah. The Dodge boys spent their early years on the floor of the foundry and learned the ins and outs of not only building all things mechanical, but also successfully running a business. After their father had relocated the family to Detroit in 1886, the 18-year-old Horace and 22-year-old John took up positions at the Murphy Boiler Works, which also sounds like a brewery in Portland.
God, you know they have like a triple IPA.
Where they helped make those gigantic steel boilers that you see rotting away in the basement of 100-year-old schools and apartment buildings because they're too massive to move. A few years later, the enterprising young brothers moved across the Detroit River to Canada and started working at the Dominion Typograph Company, where Horace precision machined steel letters and parts for printing presses, and John worked in the office. But the real magic happened in the off hours.
They banged.
Okay. While the brothers weren't...
They f***ed each other.
Oh, yeah, I got it. When the boys weren't carving letters out of steel, Horace was inventing something that is mostly taken for granted today. The lowly ball bearing.
Whoa.
He invented that.
Kind of.
Ball bearings have been... Ball bearings have been reducing friction since around 40 BC when the Romans used them on their ships. Is that the earliest thing we've ever talked about on this show?
Did we talk about the invention of the wheel at some point?
We didn't. I don't think so.
Okay, this is the earliest thing.
I think so. As I said, the Romans used them on their ships, but Horace Dodge was the first person to ever create a dirt-proof ball bearing. He used the clever enclosed bearing design for bicycles that he was building under the name Evans and Dodge. They took over the typography factory and started pumping out bikes that sold well enough due to their patented technology that John Dodge used as a marketing leverage over the other bike companies.
What a power move. Like, hey, I'm taking over this company. Yeah. We're going to make bikes now.
Building bikes now.
Yeah. Throw all those letters away. Yeah. We're going to make bikes.
The bikes are rolling off the factory floor en masse, but the Dodge brothers had other kind of wheels on the brain. Square ones, triangle ones.
They were in Canada. Cubes.
We're in Canada after all. What does that mean?
South Park. Square wheels.
Yeah. Come on, guys. Come on.
I'm not your buddy, guy.
They wanted a piece of the hot new technology of the day, the horseless carriage. So the brothers sold their share of the bike business and returned to Detroit, or as they called it in Quebec.
Yeah.
Detroit. They built their own large machine shop with about a dozen employees and started offering their engine building and engineering services to local car manufacturers. Their first real customer was Ransom Olds, who had just patented the vehicle assembly line.
So Oldsmobile doesn't just mean it's an old mobile?
No.
It's someone's
name? It's
this
dude right here.
Whoa. It would have been, I mean, Oldsmobile is kind of sick now. Like the name, but Ransom Cars?
Yeah,
that
Ransom
sounds
sick.
Yeah, that's kind of fun. Yeah, Ransom would have been way cool. Imagine if Dodge was known as Ransom. Everything would make sense.
So
instead of dodging the law, you already
dodging the law. Ransom Olds, he patented the vehicle assembly line, but not the moving assembly line that Henry Ford would later make famous. He patented a static one that Olds used to up production numbers at a time when cars were built as bespoke carriages and not mass-produced units.
You see, kids, everything's inspired off of something.
That's right. In 1902, as the number of Oldsmobiles on the road grew, Ransom Olds was in need of suppliers who could provide turnkey parts his workers could bolt into place before moving on to the next piece. The Dodge brothers started by supplying engines, but after a fire destroyed an Oldsmobile factory, they were soon asked by Ransom Olds to make 3,000 transmissions lickety-split, which they did handily. This put them on the map as the largest auto parts supplier in the fledgling Detroit automaker scene. The next year, the Dodge brothers met a farmer-turned-car builder named Henry Ford, who had just teamed up with coal purveyor Alexander Y. Malcolmson, who bankrolled the enterprising Ford.
Nice.
On February 23, 1903, the brothers signed an agreement to hand over 650 chassis to Ford by July. The chassis Ford wanted would include the engine, axles, and transmissions to be set on the assembly line for finishing. So, I mean, this is what's cool about this time in history, especially when you read these kind of stories, is like all these guys, it's like how like the Bay Area today was where all the tech companies are at.
Yeah.
And all these, you know, apps that we all use, all these companies.
Dropbox.
I mean, literally, like Dropbox, Skype, Facebook, like all these companies that we all interact with every day, they all know each other. They've all worked at each other's companies. They all split off and make their own things.
They're all sniping each other. Yeah. From Google,
they all hate each other.
Apple,
they're
Apple,
all after, Google. You know, making $1 billion. But like, that's how Detroit was back in the early 1900s. Yeah. Like, there's this idea of this, you know, the automobile is this new concept and everyone is moving to this area to, you know, try their hand at making it big and building the best thing they can. I don't know. This is really interesting.
What's our generation version of this?
I think tech.
I meant like younger. Who's meeting in a garage right now and making the next wave of the future?
I mean, I think like AI stuff, I think it still is very much tech, even though it's been for the past 20 years. It doesn't really show any sign of slowing down for me.
Yeah, we always run into this kind of thing in the past gas scripts that happen. It's like this period and then racing in like the 50s and 60s where it's like
Well, those guys, those guys were
John
all traveling.
John Alternator worked at Chrysler, and he had a good idea for an invention.
Yeah. I mean,
it's just like didn't the Wright brothers like know a bunch of other people that were also making airplanes?
I mean, very likely. I mean, you know, we know a bunch of people making YouTube videos. Like, it's
right,
all
YouTube. Like, automotive YouTube, a lot of people have known each other for a long time.
Yeah, it's a little different because it's all, it's not exactly localized like these were, but
I think that the connective tissue is that if it's a small enough community, everyone's doing a little bit of everything. So you understand how the other parts of the business work. You understand how to start machining stuff. And so like, oh, I can do this by myself.
Well, exactly. Like you're saying, like if it's fledgling and stuff and there's not people that are specialized in all those very, like look at the film right now. Like there are people who go in for, you know, gaffing or ADing.
Best boy,
like operating the camera. Whereas with like new media, we do have people in this company that have worked in traditional media, but for the most part, like everybody does a little bit of something.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
Ford needed capital to help get his new factory floor in Highland Park, Detroit, up and running. So he once again turned to the Dodge brothers, who now had funds to spare for investment. They traded $10,000, which is about $350,000 today, for 10% of Ford's stock at the time.
Jeez.
Today, what would be worth roughly $4.7 billion.
Dang.
Within 2 years, the Dodge brothers would be delivering 400 engines and transmissions to Ford per month.
Something tells me, though, that they probably don't have those stocks still.
No, they're dead. Spoiler alert. And while Henry Ford was openly looking to build his own parts and engines, Dodge still supplied the majority of their components. Ford and Dodge were locked together for almost 15 years as they were delivering hundreds of thousands of transmissions to Ford's all-new complex.
Wow.
But John and Horace were nervous about putting all their eggs in one basket, so they gave notice to Ford that they were going to head off into the sunset and find new builders to supply. At this point, John Dodge had worked his way up to vice president of the Ford Motor Company, so he resigned.
Whoa.
I didn't realize they were that intertwined.
Yeah.
That's pretty crazy. Between 1903 and 1914, the Dodge brothers had collected $3.8 million, which is $130 million today, in dividends, and pocketed another $1.7 million in profit. Ford responded by slashing the dividends paid to stockholders, and Dodge countered with a lawsuit the day after attending Henry Ford's son's wedding, which eventually cost Ford another $19 million, which is $400 million today. The Dodge brothers got 10% of that money, which is, they're just like working that business angle on a like historically business savvy guy. That's crazy.
I have a question.
Sure.
How did the stock market work before computers? Was there just some dude?
It came out of a machine as like toilet paper.
Right? Someone's just constantly crunching numbers. Like,
I have no idea, to be honest.
Like, and they would have to like ring the operator to like patch them through to someone else.
There's just so much stuff that had to mechanically happen.
Yeah.
Like,
well, as I understand it, you know, like there's you know, they still have the Wall Street. If you know anything about Wall Street, by the way, feel free to chime in about the history of Wall Street. But you know, they have the stock exchange still. There's still people on the floor doing that kind of stuff. But I think like back then that was actually more of like a true like profession, right?
Yeah,
like,
because
they're actually physically taking receipts to people and like,
right,
sure.
So those are like, you had the runners, you had the dude just chain smoking, just constantly
looking at the dials, like
fingers on fire, you know, like, whoa,
yeah,
and then they're ringing the bell for no reason.
I would watch a movie about that.
That's the stuff,
early 1900s.
There's literally a movie called Wall Street.
Well, no,
but like about the intricacies of
early days,
what was that job?
Abacuses to like,
and
then. The stock market crash was literally just like the machine falling over and crashing.
Someone breaking a finger.
It toppled the whole system.
I want to know what they're reading on the little ticker tape.
Right.
That's where it comes from, right?
We're way off topic.
Sorry.
Stonks.
Someone make it.
In July 1919, 16 years after signing that first contract, Henry Ford came knocking with an offer to buy them out for $25 million, around $500 million today.
Oof,
in total, John and Horace had made back more than $30 million on their initial $10,000 investment in 1903.
Imagine being the guy that, like, hey, Ford just called, this happened, crank the numbers.
Yeah.
All right, well, now the Dodge brothers have this. He's just like handed over. Crank,
yeah. And then it that gets sent off to the newspaper.
Right.
And then all the stock share people that own stocks read about it in the paper. And then they're like, oh, no.
Then they call their guy.
Yeah.
And then they're like, buy.
There's just
how much? What do I got? Let me go find out. They got to go. Now it runs. Someone has to run, find out how much they have that someone else had to figure out.
Yeah.
And then bring it back. It's just like the delay.
That's crazy.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
We're lazy now.
We just go on E-Trade.
I mean, they literally will like buy these stock companies will buy property closest they can to the stock exchange. So their like fiber optic cables will be shorter than their competition.
Really?
Just to have that advantage. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like it's not. Yeah.
That's nuts.
It's crazy. During all this, John and Horace had established the Dodge Motor Company and began building their own cars, which ripped to shreds the already tenuous relationship with Henry Ford. Not only had they suddenly made an enemy of Ford, they'd unwittingly forced him to bankroll their entire operation.
Let's be honest, though. Henry Ford was a piece of shit.
He was a very eccentric guy.
He deserved to be taken advantage of.
Dodge, yeah, share the wealth, baby.
Yeah.
Dodge launched off the line the same way the company still does today. Okay, come on. That's a bit. They launched off the line like a Hellcat.
Yeah,
the staging lights.
Just spinning tires the whole way.
They went big against the competition.
Did I mention the NHRA banned this car from drag racing?
Because it needs a roll cage.
Their first car was the Model 3035, made in their all-new Detroit plant. Ever the salesman, John Dodge marketed the 3035 as a better Model T, which it was. The 3035 featured an all-steel construction instead of steel over wood. It standardized the 12-volt electrical system 30 years before other car manufacturers. It featured an electric starter, a 35-horsepower engine instead of the 20-horsepower in the Model T. So by every metric, the 3035 was better than the Model T. In less than 2 years, the Dodge Motor Company went from fledgling builder to number two in car sales in the U.S., just behind Ford. Dodge had sold 45,000 units during year two, while Ford sold just over 300,000. That same year, in 1915, Ford rolled its millionth car off the production line.
That's a crazy discrepancy between number one and number two.
Yeah, that's wild. While Dodge wasn't producing quite the same numbers as Ford, the brothers' company was growing at a feverish pace. It was almost impossible to dethrone Ford, mostly because the Model T sold for just shy of $400, while the Dodge cost a solid $1,000. But by 1919, Dodge was selling 100,000 units per year and had just sold their 400,000th car.
That's still pretty impressive.
That's good. Yeah. Really good.
Yeah.
While Dodge launched with the already impressive 3035, it was the next few cars that would further solidify their name in the automotive scene. Their next vehicle was not only a massive game changer for Dodge, but it actually changed the whole industry. The Dodge Model 30 was the first all-steel-bodied car. The steel panels were the brainchild of Ed Budd.
Ed Budd.
Who would later make a name for himself building and designing trains. He saw the future of cars as being a void of chassis, or what we know as today as unibody construction. And he was right. It just took decades for him to be proven so. Ditching exterior wood panels not only extended the life of the vehicle due to termite attacks and any kind of weather, but it also extended the life of their passengers because it was much safer to be sitting in a steel box during a wreck instead of a wooden one.
Yeah, I can't go out this weekend. I have to replace the wood trim on my Model T.
Have you ever stood on like soaked through wood?
Mm-hmm.
It is the worst.
It's not good.
Yeah. Zero grip. Yeah. I've tried climbing into this thing that's as tall as a horse and then just slipping.
The 114-inch wheelbase Model 30 featured the same souped-up 35-horsepower motor and three-speed stick as the 3035. The engine and transmission gave the Model 30 a zippy response, and it was a bit quicker in traffic than other carriages and cars of the time. The 30 would top out at around 50 miles per hour, which would outpace all but the fastest ponies.
But on those kind of roads back then, that 50 was really
that's incredible.
Fast.
Yeah.
The suspension was a bit stiffer and lent itself to a more responsive driving experience as well. The only complaint auto buyers of the era had was the steep $1,000 price tag, but this was akin to comparing a Honda Civic to a BMW 3 Series. The Model T, much like the Civic, was a hardy vehicle that would take a lot of beating, but offered few creature comforts. The Dodge, much like a Beamer, would also take a beating, but it was more performance-oriented and fancy enough to make it feel like money well spent. The next important car Dodge released was the 1927 Dodge 6, which had a 116-inch wheelbase, so it's a little longer than the previous car, had gangster looks, and delivered a whopping 60 horsepower out of the 224 cubic inch six-cylinder engine. The next year, they crammed that same six-cylinder into a smaller package, this one called the Standard 6, which was 6 inches shorter and had a more of a racy exterior and sold pretty well.
So that's kind of what...
The Dodge 6 is kind of dope.
Yeah, it is cool. Putting a big engine into a small chassis is how the muscle car era popped off.
Which we'll get to. But that wasn't really Ford. That was Buick who made the very first like true muscle car out there.
Which one?
Maybe it's the Olds.
You're talking about the Rocket 88?
Is that an Olds?
Yeah.
Yeah, Rocket 88. My bad. Still not a Dodge.
But really, I mean, the Hudson Hornet, we talked about that a couple weeks ago. That was also kind of a muscle car.
That was pretty big, though, that thing.
Yeah.
Alongside the Dodge 6, they released the Fast 4, which was the missing link between the Model T-inspired 3035 and the Wayfarer, which brought Dodge into the modern era of car making. Let's take a look at this.
They all look the same.
Yeah,
except the Wayfarer, though. Wayfarer looks like way different.
The Fast 4 was rounded and sleek with a much more modern 104-inch wheelbase. The car featured amenities that Ford had laughed off as superfluous, like speedometers and a heater.
You need a speedometer in your car?
Why do you want to know? Just go fast.
So these amenities, these features, helped move the entire industry towards building cars that were more comfortable for the drivers and not just there to move them from point A to point B. And actually make them nice.
The experience.
Yeah.
Too bad they didn't keep that mentality.
Yeah. In 1920, the brothers headed to New York City to unveil their 1920 lineup of automobiles, which was basically 8 different versions of the Model 30 that included the Touring, the Sport Touring, and the Special Touring. These incorporated various types of plush seats, lighting, number of doors, and body panels. But on the way to New York, John came down with a serious illness and couldn't make it to the show. So the non-people...
Yeah, diarrhea.
I mean, no, yeah. Probably. They used to just like throw buckets of crap out their windows back then. So makes sense. I still do that. I don't want to
pay the city $15 a month to flush my toilets.
All the clean water that goes in my toilet, I just drink that instead.
All the water you use to wash the bucket, though.
Do you wash the bucket?
Oh, you wash your bucket? So because of John's illness, the non-people person Horace was forced to speak in front of the gathering of Dodge dealers by himself.
Uh-oh. That's like me on a press release.
He had one of those little like stones that has a divot in it.
Don't say something stupid.
The second he finished, he raced back to his brother's side and sat idly by. John passed away a few days later from his illness.
Oh, God. Whoops.
Damn.
Yeah. You don't feel so good about my diarrhea joke.
Diarrhea quip. No, I don't. Damn.
Well, they call that wasting disease or something.
That was fast.
Dysentery. Without John, Horace was in over his head with the money management and marketing for Dodge. He abandoned the factory in Dodge HQ and went to his Florida home where he ended up dying a few months later.
Oh, no.
What a love story.
So John died of pneumonia.
Okay.
Oh.
Yeah. And then Horace Dodge, death.
Crocodile.
Yeah, his bed was right next to the swamp.
He also contracted the flu.
Both of them got the flu?
Both of them died from pneumonia. But Horace also had cirrhosis of the liver.
Oh,
well,
so drinking guy.
Yeah, dang. It's tough.
John and Horace left behind wills that were difficult to interpret and execute. Their families were left with small amounts of money doled out monthly by lawyers, so it didn't take long for the widows to get together and sell off what was left of Dodge. Through competitive bidding, Dylan Reed and company had won the right to build Dodge cars for roughly $146 million, which is the equivalent of $2.5 billion. The new owners of Dodge were better at bean counting than building, and they started jacking up prices and slashing quality. A new Dodge car went from $1,000 to $2,000 overnight, And even the most loyal Dodge fans went and bought other cars instead.
It's funny how that's been happening for so long.
Yeah.
Not a new phenomenon.
Capitalists. Yeah. Late stage capitalism. This is early stage capitalism.
Yeah. Same story, though.
Yeah, I know. By 1928, the financiers running Dodge had blown every penny they had trying to make Dodge profitable, which bit them in the ass. It was so bad they couldn't make payroll for the 20,000 workers that were looking to feed their families, so the Dodge Motor Company went back up for sale in an attempt to clear some of the debts and make some cash back on the investment. In comes Walter P. Chrysler.
Hmm.
Walter P. Chrysler swaggered onto the scene with his big bankroll and plunkered down $170 million for the Dodge Brothers empire, which is around $3 billion today.
So they paid even more money. Interesting.
Yeah. Hmm. The purchase bumped the smaller Chrysler Corp straight into third biggest American car manufacturer. It was the largest business deal in history at the time, and Walter later said of the purchase, "Buying Dodge was one of the soundest acts of my life. I say sincerely that nothing we have done for the organization compares with that transaction."
Nice, okay.
Said like a 1928 businessman.
Within a few short years, Chrysler had righted the sinking Dodge ship and had jumped to second right behind Chevrolet. During World War I, Dodge had made a name for themselves with the U.S. military by building stout and reliable 4x4 trucks. They developed their first four-wheel drive truck way back in 1934 at the request of the U.S. government. But up until World War II, Dodge had refocused on building civilian vehicles, and they were doing an amazing job at that, except everything changed on December 7th, 1941. When the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, Dodge dropped everything they were working on and shifted straight into war mode. Dodge quickly became the sole choice for three-quarter ton trucks needed by the government. From the summer of 1942 until the day that nuclear bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Dodge built 255,193 three-quarter ton trucks for Uncle Sam. They were also the sole supplier of the 1.5-ton trucks and the main supplier of half-ton trucks. All in, Dodge pumped out more than 400,000 Axis and Nazi-defeating trucks. So that's pretty cool. I didn't know that.
War mode, dude.
That's where the Power Wagon was like a war truck at first, wasn't it?
I believe so.
They turned one of their half ton truck into like an off roader, and that's where the Power Wagon came from, I think.
Yeah, 1941 Dodge Power Wagon, dude. I want to buy one of these. That would be sick.
These are expensive.
Good luck. Best of luck to you.
Those are like the sickest trucks.
You want to go in on one?
Yeah, you want to like a timeshare, but for
hey, that's World what War the bros trucks? Do now. That's how we get a 911, guys.
Yeah.
My mom said it's my turn to drive the Power Wagon.
I saw that on a reel.
Really?
Oh. It was like, when it's your turn to get the GT4 RS.
By focusing entirely on supplying the government for almost 5 years, they won the hearts and minds of the American public, which, in the long term, proved to be much more valuable than continuing to build civilian cars during the war. Not that they could have anyway, because war rationing and all that would have prevented them. So, this set up Dodge for one of the biggest post-war success stories in the entire automotive industry and made Dodge synonymous with the word truck in America. And that is the end of part one of Dodge. Next time, it's the rise and fall of the Hemi from muscle to malaise. So can't wait for that. Gonna begin my wheelhouse there.
I can see that you're salivating.
My mouth is wet.
Because you know what made cars faster?
Trucks.
No.
Truck engines.
Little Red Express.
Yeah.
Well, the Hemi was a racing engine. Racing engine. For race cars. All right. We got some listener mail this week, Joe. Yeah.
Okay. This is from Don V.
Don V.
Hey, guys. Just listen to the episode on customs. Great job. You were wondering where the word Kemp comes from.
Oh, yeah.
And I think I can answer this one for you.
Okay.
It comes from a 1950s slang term used by California teens to describe a person who was tidy and well-dressed in the latest styles. We've all heard of a disheveled, messy person described as unkempt, so the opposite of that is called kempt, which then got shortened to Kemp, no T. It then got appropriated by the car culture to describe a car that was also clean, tidy, and well done in the latest fashion. So there you have it. On a side note, it was also extremely refreshing to hear your breast.
Breast.
I was reading
that loud breast.
Guest and Brent. Guest and Brent.
We're keeping that in, dude.
It was also extremely refreshing to hear your guest, Brent Lawson, talk about the involvement of Black, Latino, and gay people in the car scene. I'm currently in the middle of recording a podcast which talks about exactly that, how the gatekeeping and the hot rodding culture is holding things back, and how we can get around it and keep old school hot rodding from dying a slow death as the boomer generation also goes away. I listen to your podcast all the time while I'm out in my workshop wrenching on my 49 Plymouth.
Heck
sick.
Yeah.
That's sick.
And think you have the best car-related podcast out there.
Hey, thank you.
We also think so.
Thank you.
Killer job. Keep up the good work, Don V. In Rust We Trust podcast.
Hey.
Okay. Go listen to that.
That's a great name.
Check that out.
Thank you, Don V. Thank you to everyone else listening to this one.
Yeah.
This was a really fun one. I can't believe we've never done Dodge before.
Yeah, I can't believe that either.
That is actually insane.
But we have two more parts coming up next week, week after that. So tune in for those. And thank you to Justin for joining us this week.
Hey.
Nolan.
Hello.
I know you guys are tired from Tucson, so appreciate it.
Yeah, we got back yesterday.
Yeah.
See you next week. Thanks for listening.
Bye.